But they were doing better than most because the two oldest sons were in the army. They were not rebels, but regime conformists who did their best to stay alive while doing pretty much exactly what they were told. Jimmy was the black sheep. The family lived in the forgotten far northeast corner of Korea, in the town of Sabyeol in North Hamgyong province, only an hour's walk from China. The border is formed by the Tumen River running down from its source, the sacred Mount Bakdu, where regime legend has it that Kim Jong-il was born, to the East Sea or Sea of Japan. Up in the hills, the Tumen divides China and North Korea, and then, close to the sea, forms the border between North Korea and Russia for its last 11 miles. The Russian name of the river is Tumanaya, which means foggy. In the dead of winter, the surface of the river freezes over, making it so easy to cross, all you have to do is run. In the late autumn and early spring, the ice is weak, and great care must be taken, because the current is strong, and drowning a serious possibility. Jimmy had a friend, let's call him Mark, a smuggler who was making a small fortune bringing in second-hand clothes from China. Around 1997, when the famine was at its height, Mark told Jimmy that North Korea was much poorer than China. The famine had shattered much of Jimmy's belief in the system. He'd seen dead babies, dead old people, dead middle-aged people lying slumped in the street, at railway stations, or just by the doorstep of their homes. Never many bodies in one place, he said, just one or two. At 15, Jimmy got the itch to travel, and one moonless night in late November, around 2 o'clock in the morning, when the guards were, he hoped, asleep, he found himself face down, crawling across the ice, not even as thick as your finger, the only sounds the creaking of the ice as it took his weight, and the barking of dogs from China. The Tumen here, far away from the sea, was around 100 meters across, and most of the surface was hard ice, but the middle section, around 10 meters across, was perilously thin. Jimmy described a trick the smugglers used. They took two sticks, maybe 5 feet long each, and crawled forward, one in each hand, using them to spread their weight and get some traction on the ice. One stick at a time, Jimmy crawled on. To be fair, at 5'2" and not an ounce of fat on him, he would stand a far better chance at crossing thin ice than you or I. He made it. On the other side, Jimmy gorged himself with 5 or 6 bowls of white rice at one sitting. Everything Mark had told him about China turned out to be true. The food was abundant. You could eat meat and white rice every day, luxuries you only had on feast days back home. The electricity worked. You could watch whatever you wanted on telly. You could go to karaoke bars and party all night long. Jimmy returned with 40 kilos of second-hand clothes on his back. The bag he used was the same size as he was. They smuggled second-hand sports clothes, T-shirts, trousers — you are not allowed to wear jeans in North Korea — into the North. Jimmy reckoned that if the average wage was 500 won a month, he made around 2,000 won, worth roughly £200, $170, around 4 months' pay, in one run across the border. He could have been shot by the border guards or captured and then executed, but he loved the buzz. He did his best to keep his family in the dark about what he was up to, but the regime's spell over him was entirely broken. Jimmy was determined to go back, and did so, again and again. Each trip, his profits grew. And then trouble. He was on the Chinese side of the river, working his way from village to village, trying to keep away from the Chinese border guards and the police until he could get to the town where he could get hold of more second-hand clothes, when he was caught. He spent a week in a police cell in China. They fed him properly, 3 times a day, and then he was sent back to North Korea. He was only 16 and categorized as a simple border crosser, not a political defector, and after a roughish time, they let him go. His family were angry with him and they beat him up a little, but that didn't dent his conviction that there was something profoundly wrong about North Korea. Pretty soon he was on his way back into China. Not long after, Jimmy realized that smuggling second-hand clothes from China to North Korea was never going to make him a rich man. Instead, he switched to smuggling a commodity out of North Korea, where there were no real markets, into China. That commodity was gold. Jimmy explained that in the north of North Korea there was plenty of gold. Miners would sell you nuggets for a fraction of the price he could obtain in China. If you looked in the right place, you could find some yourself, just lying in streams or on the surface of the earth. His trade built up. He got to know fences on the Chinese side who would give him a good price for his gold. He also realized that with gold, far less bulky than second-hand clothes, he could swim across the river when it wasn't frozen, tripling his potential profits. Boats were never an option. They would be spotted by the border guards and destroyed. The more often he crossed the border, the richer he became. His biggest shipment had been 900 grams of raw gold nuggets worth around 150,000 won, £15,000, $17,000, and everything worked brilliantly. And then he got too greedy. Inside North Korea, someone betrayed him, and he was trapped by the police and caught with his biggest cache of gold yet, 3 kilos, worth 500,000 won, £50,000, $65,000. Had he been 18 when he was arrested with 3 kilos of North Korean gold, he would have been executed, he said. But because he was a minor, he just got 15 years in prison, hard labor. He ended up in prison camp 12, also known as the Chung-O-Ri Re-Education Center. His camp was for common criminals, not part of the political gulag, but conditions sound grim. Everyone who enters the camp is greeted by a big black metal gate, and when it opens up, a big sign behind it says, "Escape is suicide." Jimmy admitted he had a hard time, but back then, around the turn of the millennium, Prison Camp 12 was not one of those nightmare camps you hear about where guards kill people for fun. People, he said, just died from malnutrition. He was hungry for a whole year. They gave the prisoners 3 thimbles of corn a day or some salty soup, sometimes with bits of cabbage. The food was so bad that even a pig would have turned his nose up. If anyone managed to catch a rat, they were the luckiest person alive because it was at least meat. Some people ate grass, others bits of corn in cow shit. His mother got him out after a year, bribing the doctors and the guards, claiming he had tuberculosis. It cost his mum around £400, a king's ransom in North Korea. The authorities are nervous of anyone with TB. With a prison population on the edge of starvation, dozens can die with one outbreak, and that can be bad for production targets. Corruption has grown more common, by all accounts, since the famine. Money can only buy so much. If someone is in serious trouble with the buibu, then no amount of money can save them. Since Jimmy was banged up inside Prison Camp 12, around the year 2000, conditions have reportedly got far worse. It's become the main prison camp for would-be border crossers, people who jump the border to make money, not necessarily to defect for good. But since the famine, when everything went to pot, crossing the border has been treated more severely. The One Free Korea website reports hard labor is much heavier at Prison Camp 12 than at other ordinary re-education centers, and torture and beatings are routine. The website says that anybody who has crossed the border is automatically sentenced to up to 3 years of forced labor at Prison Camp 12, under instructions that they are to be punished as traitors. This marks a change from Jimmy's period of captivity, when simple defectors, not gold smugglers, got a few months in prison and then were freed. One defector who had a hair's breadth escape from Prison Camp 12 said, "Chung-O-Ri is a living hell. Yodok the notorious Camp 15, is a much better place. If the physical beatings don't finish them off, inmates of Prison Camp 12 are doomed to die of malnutrition. The website's information squares with the general clampdown against defectors running to China, which has taken place in the last 5 years. Similarly, numbers of successful defections to South Korea have fallen by half. It fits that the authorities are not just stepping up border patrols, but making life far tougher on those who try to defect. Another inmate of Prison Camp 12, Lee Jun-ha, wrote a diary of his experience, published by the Daily NK website. It's a haunting read, and it backs up details of Jimmy's story. Lee recalled that when he entered the camp, he saw a large metal entrance gate. To the right, written in large black letters, were two frightening warnings: "Those caught trying to escape will be shot," and "Escape is suicide." Lee continued, "Off to the left, I saw a group of inmates with sanitation tags on their arms haphazardly loading logs onto a big truck labeled Independence Number 82. Or I thought they were logs, anyway. As I looked closer, I realized they were corpses. My heart rose into my throat and I went stiff. Only one thought came to me. I'm a dead man." Jimmy's sick-letter trick only worked for a while, though. After a spell, the authorities want you back in prison to deal with that problem. Jimmy went on the run, and while on the run, it made sense to get back to the only job he knew well, smuggling gold to China. He got caught 3 times, and he managed to escape 3 times. The first time he was fingered by someone in China. The military caught him, but it was too late at night to take him to a proper cell, so one of the soldiers handcuffed him to the post of a bunk bed and then crashed out fast asleep. Using the skills he learnt as a key cutter in Prison Camp 12, Jimmy unpicked the lock of the handcuffs and was out of the barracks before you could say Kim Jong-il. The second time he got nicked was in North Korea. He was locked in an office with iron bars over the windows while the authorities went looking for further evidence against him. While they were away, he used a poker from the fireplace stove to jemmy open the bars of the windows, and, remember, he is the smallest fully grown man I've ever met, wriggled out through the gap to freedom. The third time was the most unlucky. He got caught close to his hometown, and that made everything more difficult. Elsewhere in North Korea he could grease palms, but in his home area the authorities knew he had previous. Execution or an eternity in Prison Camp 12 were the only options. He'd been locked in a room. There was no way out, or so he thought, at first. He studied the door frame and noticed there was a significant gap between it and the door. Through that gap he realized that the door was not properly locked but held on a latch. He searched the room and found a length of wire, and he was out. The risks of continuing the smuggling lark were just too great. By this time he'd met and fallen in love with a woman who had become his wife, let's call her Grace. She was reluctant to leave, being, he explained, much more brainwashed than he was, but she didn't want to split with him, so the two of them dared to try and make it across to China one last time. It was March 2003, and the once-frozen river had thawed since the winter, although chunks of ice as big as boulders still flowed downstream. Grace was very scared, so to reduce her distress, he swam across the river, carrying her on his shoulders. It was an extraordinary feat because the river at that crossing point was 120 meters wide, the water freezing, and he is such a tiny man. Once on the Chinese bank, he collapsed and passed out for an hour. Although Jimmy had known what life was like outside the North, for Grace it was a great shock, and after a few days she wanted to go back, even though she could see life was better in China. He won the argument, knowing that to go back would mean certain death. Jimmy had saved up a lot of money and he had plenty of contacts in China, so within 20 days he and Grace managed to get to Vietnam, where they waited 3 months for an opportunity to be sent to South Korea, and then spent another 3 months in an immigration centre. Once there, the terror of being caught and sent back was gone, and Grace settled into her new life well. After working a couple of years in South Korea, he was the victim of a confidence trickster and lost a lot of his money. It broke his confidence because he didn't know that con men would take advantage of people like him. Upset and at a loss, a relative suggested that he and Grace come to Britain. The gold smuggler turned Harry Houdini of North Korea now makes his living as a fishmonger in New Malden in southwest London, just off the A3. Jimmy's thrived in Britain and is making so much money that he can afford to send back £1,000 every 6 months or so. He wires the money to a broker in China who takes a cut. The cash, most commonly in Chinese yuan, is smuggled across the river to another broker on the North Korean side. The smuggling is often done by border guards, the brokers, their relatives or friends. The brokers, Chinese and North Korean, together take a slice of around 30%, so Jimmy's mum ends up with £700, not bad for the black sheep of the family. They live so close to the border that she has a Chinese phone. She rings once and he phones her back. They talk on the phone to make sure that the money has come, that they haven't been cheated, and chat about simple family things. They last spoke 2 months before we met. Guan, my translator, had his computer out, and together we looked at his old hometown on Google Earth. The sight of it made him homesick. He'd go back tomorrow if they would let him do so in peace, which, of course, they won't. When he sees North Koreans weeping over Kim Jong-un on the television, he thinks they are stupid and naive. I asked him whether he thought the tears of joy were genuine. He said yes, because they have only ever lived inside the North Korean bubble. On Kim 3, Jimmy said that he hoped he dies. Either the West knock him down or someone inside the North overthrows him. The quicker the better. And at that, rebellious as ever, he broke into a grin. Chapter 6. Pyongyang Zoo. In 1991, Osijek in old Yugoslavia, new Croatia, was full of blood. One day, photographer Paul Jenks and I walked in the back door of the town's hospital because the Serbs were raining down artillery shells on the main entrance and found ourselves in the morgue. No power, not much light. Flies gorged themselves on the blood of 20 dead men, their rib cages zipped wide open for post-mortem, like so many blood-pink human butterfly wings. Sick of the killing, we went to the zoo, empty of people but still full of animals. The front line was the wild goat enclosure. Paul and I convinced Rose, an impossibly sexy zookeeper-cum-warrior, to feed the animals. I still have Paul's picture of Rose feeding a giraffe a biscuit, her Kalashnikov on her shoulder. The war between Serbs and Croats stopped, but a few days later, Paul was shot dead in strange circumstances. 3 years on, I returned to Osijek to investigate who had killed Paul, and I went back to the zoo. It was snowing and the zoo looked entirely empty. Then, hopping into vision, came a crowd of wallabies. It was a magical moment. Since then, in times of war or places ruled by fear, I go to the zoo. Baghdad Zoo in Saddam's time was one of the most melancholy places I've ever been to. The animals mangy, the creatures' loss of liberty no different from the humans. There was even a photograph of Saddam in the aquarium, so the guppy could pay homage to the big man with the moustache. But even there, in Baghdad Zoo under Saddam, I didn't have a minder who followed me around from cage to cage. At Pyongyang Zoo, we had three, Mr. Hyun, Miss June, and a new local guide, who spoke a smattering of English, and greeted us at the entrance. Zoos, I know, are not good because they restrict animal freedom. But in many parts of the world, free-moving, free-living animals get shot for their ivory, their skin, or their meat, or because they are in the wrong place, and I fear that my grandchildren's generation will only know the great animals through trips to the zoo, or places like them. And there is the fascinating anthropology of the zoo, looking at them, looking at us. My addiction to zoos is partly because they remind me of the time when my children were little, and every moment with a 5-year-old staring at a gorilla picking its bottom is full of low comedy, partly because, brilliant as David Attenborough's natural history documentaries are, you can't smell an elephant on the telly, and partly because zoos are no man's land, where people can think about what makes us human and them animal, and what combines all of us living creatures, where politics stops. But not, of course, in Pyongyang. Somewhere around were a brace of chimps presented by General Suharto of Indonesia and a warthog, a gift from Robert Mugabe. Hitchens tells the story of a friend who goes to Pyongyang Zoo and finds the animals half-starved, stunted. He inspects a parrot, who looks at him with a beady eye. He looks back, morose, and after a short interval the parrot opens its beak and says, "Long live the great leader Kim Il-sung!" Our tour started with homage to Kims, major and minor. The local guide, dressed in hunting pink, told us how the zoo had been built thanks to the wise and inspired guidance of Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il. After a while, you zone out. The praise to the great leader and the dear leader slides over the surface of the mind like those darker globules of vinegar slide among the olive oil in fancy restaurants. Something like this must happen inside the minds of the North Koreans, too. You listen to it, but your thoughts are elsewhere. The aquarium came first. Dimly lit pools of green, mouths opening and closing behind thick walls of glass. Sturgeon, big mothers, gulping at not very much. Then Siamese sharks, who are not proper sharks but fish, box jaws, big fins, nasty teeth, piggy-eyed, and some of the ugliest creatures I've ever seen. The tour cameraman has a nice shot of Alex filming them. I was keen, no, impatient, to get to the elephants. Marching along, we saw a bunch of soldiers digging a great hole in the earth by hand, their earthworks planted with 9 red and blue Korean flags. Coming the other way were 2 old men carrying immense bundles on their backs, fodder for the elephants, chickens for the lions. Anywhere else in the world, zoo staff would move supplies around on little electric trucks. In North Korea, the trucks have human axles. Miss June wanted to slow me down. "Professor, professor, not so fast!" I liked her, but the lack of freedom to go for a walk on your own, the inability to escape, made my teeth grind. One felt infantilized. The big cats lived in a terrace of iron cages. A lion trotted up and down his scruffy patch of concrete morosely, but he was trumped by a magnificent white Siberian tiger, lean and mean in a cage constructed of crisscrossed wire that didn't look that strong. I've never seen one before. In this respect, I told Miss Kim, North Korea is superior to Britain. "DPRK," whispered Miss Kim. The regime hates being reminded that it is one of 2 geographical halves, and both Miss Kim and Mr. Joe would always correct us if we used the phrase North Korea. Alex was filming us. "Could we feed one of the students, maybe Alex, to the tiger?" I suggested. "Alex, I think it would be a useful sacrifice." Tiger, tiger, burning bright, smacked his chops and looked like he fancied a bit of Welsh rarebit El Greco. The snack unforthcoming, Tiger washed his whiskers with a great paw and rolled his back against a spot of concrete warmed in the sun. As we were about to move on, Alex's camera caught a pluck saying in Korean, then English, "The animals presented by the dear leader Kim Jong-il on September the 22nd, Juche 99, 2010, Korean tiger, Panthera tigris altaica." Juche 99 is a result of the regime's decision to create a new calendar, with Juche year zero starting on the 15th of April, Anno Domini 1912, the date on which Kim Il-sung was born. The Juche revolution is so powerful it can turn back time, or so they would like to have us believe. In Juche time, 2013 is year 101. What is striking about every single attempt by an authoritarian state to reset the clock is not success, but failure. The French revolutionaries did it, renaming the 22nd of September 1793 as the beginning of year 2. The months got new start dates and lovely new poetic names, so that late October, often foggy, became Brumaire, the foggy one, and the next month Frimaire, because it is frosty in late November. Napoleon scrapped the whole thing because it was silly and didn't work. Pol Pot in Cambodia reset his totalitarian clock to year zero in 1974. That experiment in blood and time lasted but 4 years. The Juche year zero, although backdated to 1912, actually commenced operation in 1997 after a governmental decree. On our trip, for all practical purposes, it was never used and very rarely alluded to. Some of the regime's propaganda, which used the Western calendar before 1997, has been cast in bronze or stone or even chiselled into high peaks up in the mountains. Take, for example, the dates on the Arc de Triomphe lookalike in downtown Pyongyang. On one leg of the arch is written 1925, the year in which Kim Il-sung set out on the road to national liberation, and on the other, 1945, commemorating the year of liberation from the Japanese. Surely these dates should be converted to Juche time. But would people, especially foreigners, guess the significance of 13 and 32, or would worshippers of the Douglas Adams cult believe that 32 was a typo for 42, the answer to life, the universe, and everything? The cost of airbrushing these dates to the new calendar must be so astronomical, no one has bothered. So, Juche time lingers on, an embarrassing experiment in time travel, but not one that bites very hard on ordinary or even official life. Just how long will Juche time last? Either not a second longer than the regime or nuclear Armageddon, whichever happens first. Our tour continued. It turned out that the big cats had a big back garden at the rear of their terrace of cages, and we could look down on them from on top of an elevated concrete walkway. A lion and a tiger were mixed up in the same paddock, but seemed to be getting along nicely. Well, they weren't eating each other. The zoo was turning out to be far more impressive, or to be exact, far less pitiful, than, say, the heavy machine complex. Perhaps that's because the zoo animals and the children who come to gaze at them are core class, the factory workers not. The elephant house seemed top-notch, the elephants living behind a wall of glass, presumably to keep the heat in during the bitterly cold Korean winters. But the light was natural and beginning to die as dusk approached, so we could only make out some grey myths in the gloom, and closer to us, the unmistakable grassy cannonballs of elephant poo. At this point, it emerged that our local guide in hunting pink had met the new leader, Kim Jong-un. I pronounced it Kim Jong-un, but Miss June corrected me. The un rhymes with bun. The zoo guide's face lit up at the very mention of his name. When? On the 26th of May 2012, a date forever great in her memory. It was the happiest moment of her life, translated Miss June. The guide had also met Kim Jong-il in 2008. Which was her favourite, I asked, a question which caused Miss June to gasp. You could see the unease on their faces begin to grow. The local guide replied, "If you have a daughter and a beautiful wife, which do you love the most?" I replied, "I am sorry for my foolish question," and Miss June buckled, laughing with relief. On the other side of the glass, a young Asian elephant tucked into some juicy grass, oblivious to the human follies going on behind him. The zoo was hardly busy, but there were a good number of schoolchildren around, most of them in fancy-ish Chinese-made puffer jackets. Pyongyang is the home of the elite, who number some 200,000, maybe more. Part of the solidity of the regime is that they know their lives of relative privilege will be over if the dynasty falls. It's different in, say, China, where there is no nation-state of South China that will take over the whole shooting match if the Communist Party falls from power. The very success of South Korea means that it is harder for those who have a stake in the regime to welcome change. Change means takeover by South Korea. Change means the end of privilege and perhaps the end of life. So the calculation by members of the outer circle of the elite in Pyongyang is different to that of their counterparts in Baghdad under Saddam or Tripoli under Gaddafi. After Saddam or Gaddafi, the big players would, with a bit of luck, still be big players. If Kim Jong-un falls, then Pyongyang's privileged will end up in a new whole Korea run by the South, ignorant, backward, poor, and utterly discredited. And the consequence of that lack of hope means, thus far, no rebellion. The Snake House was the tackiest show in the zoo. In sepulchral light, the snake keeper, an old lady of indeterminate age, dressed shabbily, walked into a large glass box and picked up an enormous Burmese python, caressed it, then shoved its head a few feet from ours, though we were on the other side of the glass. Snake Woman had looked after the snake for 30 years, but last year she also met Kim Jong-un. As the great snake slithered and coiled in front of us, its forked tongue flashing in and out, I asked, "What did she think of Kim Jong-un?" The coinciding of the question about the young deity with the snake freak show was too much, and the conversational temperature between Miss June and me dropped 20 degrees. I changed the subject, fast. "Is she not afraid of that snake?" And we moved on to look at the creatures that creepeth upon the face of the earth. As ever, they were ditch-water dull. Lizards flicked their tongues, insects did their insecty thing. The usual. The plaque outside the Snake House cum Aquarium said, "To the dear leader comrade Kim Jong-il, by Mr. Jonas Wahlström, director of the Skansen Aquarium, Sweden." I wondered to myself how many creatures in the zoo had perished in the bleak winters during the famine when North Korea could no longer heat or feed or provide power and light to its people. Quite a few, I would imagine. The story goes that even in the Central Committee office in Pyongyang, the dead center of power for the Korean Workers' Party, the water in the fish tank froze to ice, entombing the goldfish therein. On we walked around the zoo. No litter underfoot because there were no kiosks flogging ice cream or sandwiches or coffees. It was forbiddingly tidy. On the way out, our guide opened a door and we were given a special treat. The white tiger was munching his way through a chicken, every bone going down with a sinister crunch. Our last stop of the day was a bookshop in town. There were countless books by Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il. In short, nothing worth buying. Chapter 7. The Scariest Place on Earth. Day 4. It's good morning, Pyongyang, until we switch on the TV news. A newsreader in Barbara Cartland, pink, shrieks something in Korean. It doesn't sound like there's been a royal wedding, Kim Dynasty style. Her delivery is extraordinary, comic opera aggressive, to my ear, profoundly, almost mockingly silly. It's only when we get back to London and get the tapes translated that we realise what she's saying. It's not good news. The military leadership is announcing from this moment that mainland America, Hawaii, and US military bases in the Pacific Rim, South Korea, and the surrounding area are being targeted. Our troops and long-range rockets are being prepared for war. That very morning we were going into the DMZ, which President Bill Clinton once called the scariest place on Earth. The DMZ is certainly the most badly named place on Earth, because it bristles with soldiery, landmines, barbed wire and machine gun nests. From further back, the North Koreans have chemical and nuclear weapons targeted at Seoul, ready to rain down a sea of fire. The South Koreans rely on the American nuclear umbrella. In the old days, the North Koreans would just have hit Seoul very hard, a tragedy for South Korea, but a local disaster, not a planet-wide one. What is different now, in the second decade of the 21st century, is that North Korea has got serious missiles and nuclear bombs. Some missiles fizzle out and go pop shortly after launch, to the embarrassment of the dynasty and the relief of the rest of the world, but they have succeeded in lobbing a missile over Japan, which fell into the sea on the far side of the island nation. This is very bad news. North Korean propaganda has put out a graphic of deadly missile fire raining down on Washington, D.C., Texas, Los Angeles, and Hawaii. The voiceover spouts, "If we compare it to body parts, the Washington missile is to take out the eyes and ears that monitor the world in one strike." We didn't see masses of military traffic on the road down to the DMZ. A few lorries and jeeps, that was all. The land is barren, denuded of trees, because they were chopped down for firewood or even, during the famine, for bark to eat. It's the least green countryside I've ever seen outside of the Sahara. Big puddles walled by low cliffs of mud lined the road. In the summer they would be rice paddies. Further off, dead fields stretched away to the horizon. It was late March, and there wasn't that much agricultural work being done, but what we could see from our coach was being carried out by hand. Every now and then we would see an ox pulling a plough. Tractors were a rarity. By the side of the road, peasants carried enormous, ballooning bags of firewood or other goods on their back. It was like driving through a film set for the Middle Ages. Modernity did intrude, though. On high escarpments, we could make out the black fingers of anti-aircraft guns poking at the sky. Every 5 miles or so, and especially where the highway was channeled between high rocks either side, two twin concrete pillars faced each other, as high as a two-story house, their bases conspicuously thinner than the bulk of the block. They were tank traps, so constructed that just a small fag packet of TNT would bring the concrete pillars crashing down, blocking the road. The road south to the DMZ is, of course, also the obvious route any invading force would take north. The twin pillars reminded me a little of the two kings in the Lord of the Rings film trilogy, warning travellers to turn back before it was too late. We pressed on. The coach slowed to a stop at a checkpoint. Generally, our coach would whiz through any official stop point, while ordinary folk had to go through the hoops. But today things seemed a little edgier. The checkpoints weren't much, a concrete booth at the side of the road, a chain across the tarmac, in one case just a line of small rocks. Mr. Hyun called out, "No photos, no photos!" The soldiers at the checkpoints seemed jumpy, and that edginess communicated itself to Mr. Hyun. As the coach accelerated away, one of the students at the back took a sneak shot of the soldiers. At the next checkpoint, trouble. The soldiers at the last checkpoint had radioed ahead to the next one, and when we turned up, Mr. Hyun got an earful. He went straight to Alex, not the culprit, grabbed him by the cuff, and dragged him off the coach and demanded he delete everything he had filmed. Alex fiddled with his camera, selecting the stills memory, and deleted a couple of boring shots of the countryside. Mr. Hyun came back onto the bus, breathed a bit more fire, and then we were on our way again. To me, it felt like Mr. Hyun was acting out a role, but then it wasn't my collar that was felt. The start of the DMZ proper was marked by an electrified fence, and past that, a small lip in the road. To left and right, we could see a concrete wall not much higher than a man, and beyond that, a depression or a waterless motor fair, making the job of the invader that bit tougher. If, of course, the invader was foolish enough to come through the front door, exactly as the defender expected. Edged around the moat was a decoration of barbed wire, the old-fashioned kind that you rarely see in the West, apart from at remote Welsh hill farms. We passed two ox carts while Mr. Hyun announced that we were now approaching the DMZ. He instantly corrected his American pronunciation into the Queen's English, the DMZ. But we noticed, all right. The coach slowed underneath a concrete block suspended above the road, another tank trap, and parked outside a building with the feel of a bad motorway service station from the 1960s. Inside was a lecture room, complete with photographs of the Kims, major and minor, and a map of the DMZ. Our host was the colonel in charge of the DMZ that day, a jolly chap in a too large hat who didn't seem to have a care in the world. If thermonuclear war was about to happen, this guy would most likely be dead in the first 5 minutes. On foot now, we walked to the southernmost tip of North Korea. Just before we got there, we passed a shrine to Kim Il-sung, on which the great leader's wisdom was scrawled in giant Korean ideograms on a fat slab of marble. It clearly says 1994-7-7. Did the great leader get the wrong date? No, Jucha time didn't come in until 3 years later. But no one had bothered to retrospectively correct the general's old-fashioned use of the Western calendar. Miss June addressed us urgently. "This area is a battlefront. Be careful all the time. Don't use your camera." This was, of course, rubbish. The DMZ was far quieter than, say, Hyde Park, although it was the only place I heard birdsong in our whole stay in North Korea. "Landmines are great for biodiversity," a lunatic collecting butterflies for London's Natural History Museum in the middle of a minefield in Angola once told me. I suspected the birds were South Korean, peering in at the misery of the North. Bang on the DMZ crossing point, where no one crosses, you look down on three blue huts. On the other side, you can see the South Korean base, a fancy pagoda affair dripping with CCTV cameras. They filmed us. We filmed them, etc., etc. Not a soul was to be seen on the other side. Normally, South Korean guards strut their stuff, while North Koreans do likewise. Occasionally, American troops join the face-off. Today, no one was in sight, apart from a small coachload of students and a fake history professor. What the American and South Korean military made of our posturing in front of their cameras, who knows? The North Korean colonel happily posed for pictures with all of us. Thermonuclear cheese? No better opportunity to find out what the prospects were of us being so much burnt toast. "At the moment," I asked the North Korean colonel, "this is a war of words. Do you think there will be a shooting war?" The colonel replied, "There is no shooting, so you can't say this is a war. I don't know if war will break out. Whether there is a war depends on the Americans." There was something about my grey beard which the colonel liked. Leastways, as the coach took us away from the very front line to a small museum where the original armistice agreement is kept, he came and sat next to me. I was keen for Alex to shoot this cozy scene, proof, if proof were needed, that despite the official propaganda, the North Korean officer in charge of the DMZ that day could not have been more relaxed. But Alex was so spooked by Mr. Joe back at the checkpoint that he didn't take the snaps. In the museum proper, the colonel picked my brains about the prospect of war. I tried to think of a diplomatic formula for telling him, "I don't think all-out war is that likely because your regime is full of shit." What I actually said was, "In Britain, we're less afraid because we're further away." For some reason, Miss June translated that as, "He wants to leave now because he is afraid war might break out," to which the colonel slapped me affectionately on the back and, laughing, said, "Don't worry about it." The new leader's photograph was hanging in pride of place in the Armistice Museum, Kim Jong-un grabbing a pair of binoculars with black gloves, scowling at the unseen enemy, while elderly North Korean generals in Sovietische hats too big for them looked on nervously. Of all the fingers on nuclear triggers, Obama's, Putin's, Cameron's, the leaders of China, France, Israel, Pakistan, India, and North Korea, Kim Jong-un's are the most immature. In a society like North Korea, moulded by Confucianism, which venerates the wisdom of the old and where the last two leaders were in office until they were very old men, Kim Jong-un's youth is a negative. Journalism, or at least the glamorous end of journalism, is about breaking news, best intoned in a basso profundo with a ticker running along the bottom of the television screen reinforcing the message. But perhaps the more interesting bit of the job is, so long as your evidence is strong, telling power and money what you say is not true. Kim Jong-un had been screaming thermonuclear threats at the outside world through the loud hailer of the North Korean propaganda machine. When Panorama broadcast the colonel's "Don't worry about it," that may have pricked fat boy Kim's balloon. Perhaps Kim Jong-un was talking up the threat to make himself look good in the eyes, not of his people, they don't matter to him, but his generals. "Behold, I am a man the West should be afraid of." But only a fool plays around with the idea of making nuclear war a reality, and that is not good for the peace of the world. After we left Pyongyang, we flew to London, and then, after a few days, flew almost all the way back, this time to South Korea. There I met Professor Myers, whose life's work is to study the mindset of the North Korean regime. Did he think war likely? Myers said that the regime didn't want war, but it might happen by miscalculation. I asked him to talk me through a possible pathway to such an event. "It would be very easy, actually. All it needs is for the North Koreans to launch another attack along the lines of the ones that they launched in 2010. In that year, the North Koreans shelled an island in disputed waters in the Yellow Sea, not far from the crumbling barrage we visited, killing two South Korean farmers and two soldiers. A South Korean frigate in international waters, but not far from the disputed islands, sank, and the only credible explanation for the sinking was that a North Korean torpedo was responsible. 46 South Korean sailors were killed. Myers continued, "If they were to sink another South Korean ship or attack one of those islands in the Yellow Sea again, the South Korean administration this time would probably respond with more force than it did in 2010. Now, being a military-first state, North Korea cannot simply let even a small military defeat ride. If that defeat becomes known to the North Korean public as a whole, the regime has to fight back. It has to raise the ante and come out of it with some kind of victory. so I do see that kind of a situation escalating quite quickly into war. In trying to calibrate the likelihood of a war, and of that war becoming nuclear, one should never forget the stance of the South. From its formation in 1945 by the Americans to the late 1980s, it endured a series of deeply unpleasant dictatorships with a thin and unconvincing gloss of elections and a muzzled free press. From the Seoul Olympics in 1988 onwards, democracy in South Korea has flourished, as has the economy, which, at number 11 in the league table of the world's richest nations, puts into shade the miserable ruin up north. The South puts up with its neighbour from hell with great patience. The question is, has that patience got a limit? The darker war games in the Pentagon look at the following scenario: that North Korea kills a number of South Koreans in an attack that Seoul believes must be responded to, that the South's response triggers the North to launch an artillery strike on Seoul, including using its chemical arsenal, and that forces the Americans' hand, requiring them to launch their tactical nuclear weapons to push back, at which point the North Koreans push the big red button for full-scale thermonuclear war. But not everyone who knows the North intimately believes the regime's martial posturing is for real. The North Korean People's Liberation Front works out of the top floor of a ramshackle house in a run-down part of Seoul, but its members are North Korean defectors with military experience, and their best contacts are in the North Korean military too. When I met Yang Se-yul of the NKPLF, he told me that he had spoken to a military source in the North just 3 days before. "What did your source say?" I asked. "There will be no war," said Yang. "Why was your source so certain that there will be no war?" Yang made an important distinction. "We should separate the army into two different groups, the senior officers and the ordinary soldiers. The senior officers don't want a war, but the soldiers have been brainwashed. They are in a state of conflict. The senior officers are aware that this whole thing is a political show, but the soldiers consider real war a possibility. The officers are used to this kind of situation." How strong is the internal position of Kim Jong-un? The regime's opposition, who can actually act, are very rare, but there are quite a few supporters. The opposition who can act, maybe five people, maybe two. He wasn't specific, nor, I suppose, could he be. "But their supporters," he continued, "are a much bigger number, generally the wealthy. You'd think the poor would support the opposition, but surprisingly, most of the opposition comes from the upper middle class. The reason behind this is that they have more information." How do they know the truth? There are many routes for information about the outside world: forced labor, North Koreans who work abroad, some in logging camps in Russia, often under miserable conditions for little money, but far, far better than they know in the North; traders, people who have to go abroad on diplomatic missions; anyone who goes to China. If an ordinary person gets to see or hear one piece of information about the outside world, then the rich in Pyongyang get to see or hear a great deal. And the restrictions on information for these people are less rigid compared to those for normal people. Exile warps minds. A group of defectors who are desperate to see the end of the regime may well over-egg their opposition pudding. But at the time of writing, all the regime's talk of thermonuclear war has come to naught, and the North Korean People's Liberation Front's analysis has proved thus far right. Telling porkies about one's readiness to stage nuclear war wasn't the only big lie hanging in the air at the DMZ. 3 million people died in the Korean Civil War. Who started it matters. I asked the colonel whether it might have been the North. He said something something in Korean. "That's not true," translated Miss June. "It's not true?" "That's not true," she repeated. Telling lies about history matters, too. Towards the end of his long life, Stalin grew increasingly dejected. I am finished. I trust no one, not even myself. But in 1950, Stalin trusted Kim Il-sung's optimism that war against the South would be swift. Kim had pressed Stalin repeatedly to be allowed to make war against the South, convinced that it would crumble under pressure. The Soviet commissar Shtikov met Kim on the 30th of January 1950 and told him the good news that Stalin, after a lot of hesitation, was now in favor of war. Shtikov's cable to Stalin reads, "Kim Il-sung received my report with great satisfaction." In April, Kim went to Moscow. As a Soviet memo at the time records, "The attack will be swift and the war will be won in 3 days. The guerrilla movement in the south has grown stronger and a major uprising is expected." The three-day war ended up lasting 3 years. It was a terrible mistake, one that millions, but neither Kim nor Stalin, paid for with their blood. At first, things went brilliantly for the North Koreans. Diplomats in the British Embassy in Seoul, only 40 miles from the border, listened to the sound of battle on the streets outside and waited for the knock on the door. The ambassador was Vivian Holt, a brilliant linguist and a good and sweet man, almost too innocent for the cruelties of the Cold War chess game. One of his aides, the double agent, George Blake. The British capitulated to the North Koreans, who treated them with a rapidly decreasing degree of civility. Kim's soldiers swept the whole of the peninsula, apart from one fraction of land outside Pusan, formerly called Pusan, a port in the southeast. Then the Americans struck, twice. Diplomatically, they secured United Nations backing for the defense of South Korea, meaning that soon Australian, Belgian, British, Canadian, Colombian, Dutch, Ethiopian, French, Greek, Luxembourg, New Zealand, Filipino, South African, Thai, and Turkish troops were on their way. Militarily, General MacArthur staged a brilliant amphibian invasion at Incheon and punched his way through to Seoul and then further and further north, almost all the way to the Chinese border. The Korean People's Army all but collapsed, a broken force. Pyongyang was evacuated, Kim's prisoners shot in a mass killing. But as the United Nations forces neared the Yalu River and the Chinese border, Mao felt threatened. The chairman struck back, sending hundreds of thousands of Chinese troops into the north. The human wave attacks by the Chinese overcame the United Nations forces, especially the British Gloucestershire Regiment, who were dreadfully mauled. The Chinese elbowed the North Korean army aside and pushed down to the 38th parallel. By the summer of 1951, the front line was pretty much where the border between the two halves of Korea had been at the start. Everyone was in favor of a ceasefire, apart from Stalin, who kept the war going for 2 more years. When Stalin died in March 1953, his successors in the Kremlin soon gave the go-ahead for peace talks, and a ceasefire agreement took effect from July 1953. The Korean Civil War was a disaster for humanity. Atrocities occurred on both sides, as happens in every war. The United Nations forces, led by the Americans, used their firepower to bomb the North, the Soviets, and the Chinese to the negotiating table, dropping more explosives on North Korea than they had on Nazi Germany. The effect was to flatten the North. Only 3 buildings survived intact in Pyongyang. Hundreds of thousands of civilians died in the bombing. The detailed history of the war has been told brilliantly elsewhere. Werner Bischoff, a Swiss photographer for the Magnum agency, took some incredibly powerful images of refugees on the run from the war. A second series of photographs has recently been unearthed in the old communist-era archives of the Hungarian Foreign Office by an academic sleuth, Balázs Szalonti. One picture of Pyongyang looks like Hiroshima or Nagasaki after the atomic bombs. One can make out a curbstone, a few spindly trees here and there, the skeletons of three buildings. The rest, as far as the eye can see, is rubble. A second picture shows three child corpses huddled, as if in sleep, in the foreground, a few feet away, a man and a woman, lost in grief. The suffering of ordinary people was hideous. Maria Barlog, a Hungarian diplomat working for the Soviet satellite, reported on the 7th of February 1951 from Pyongyang. Korea has become a pile of ruins. There are no houses or buildings left. Cities and villages have been blown up or destroyed by bombing or burned down. The population lives in dugouts in the ground. The people are literally without clothes or shoes. There is no food. They eat the frozen cabbage roots unearthed from under the snow. Cholera, typhus, infections, meningitis. They are not prepared against these epidemics. There is no medicine, and there are not enough medical personnel. There is no soap. Here, for instance, women wash their clothes without soap in the river because there is no firewood. More than 60 years on, I saw with my own eyes that women still wash clothes in the freezing rivers of North Korea. Blake, originally a Dutch citizen who became a British spy and then turned double agent for the communists during the Korean War, cited the bombing campaign as the thing that turned his mind against the West. In Holland, during the war, when I heard at night the heavy drone of hundreds of RAF planes overhead on their way to Germany, the sound had been like a song to me. Now, when I saw the enormous grey hulks of the American bombers sweeping low to drop their deadly load over the small, defenceless Korean villages huddled against the mountainside, when I saw the villagers, mostly women and children and old people, for the men were all at the front, being machine-gunned as they fled to seek shelter in the fields, I felt nothing but shame and anger. But one cannot condemn the American bombing on its own while ignoring the cause of the war. The RAF bombing of Germany during the Second World War, which so heartened Blake, was morally no different than the Allied bombing of Korea, which so sickened him. Innocent men, women, and children were killed by the RAF, but no one in the RAF had wanted to drop bombs over Germany until Hitler invaded Poland and started the Second World War. Equally, the American